Support for WMNF comes from our members in the ACT Spay, Neuter, and Wellness Clinic, presenting the Spaghetti and No Balls Dinner on March 25th, 5 to 8 p.m. at Buca del Pepe, De Pepo, I should say, and Brandon. More at actampa.org. You may have received a letter from WMNF telling you it's time to renew your membership or asking you to challenge other listeners to give to WMNF. Please return that letter with your gift today. If you didn't get that letter, that's okay. You can give online anytime at WMNF.org to this show's tip jar, Talking Animals Tip Jar, specifically, or call us weekdays at 813-238-8001. Thanks for keeping WMNF on the air. I'm Duncan Strauss, really delighted to be bringing another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll speak with writer Peter Gwynn about his extraordinary new piece about rhino poaching in the current edition of National Geographic. First, though, as always, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune, highly relevant one here. This is the Starlight Mints with Rhino Stomp here on Talking Animals. This is the Starlight Mints with Rhino Stomp, animal tune of sorts, to ease us into today's edition of Talking Animals, particularly relevant with our rhino discussion coming up. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that's devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Peter Gwynn, an award-winning staff writer at National Geographic magazine, whose article in the March issue, Rhino Wars, examines the current state of rhinos and rhino poaching in South Africa and other regions. It's a deeply reported, extraordinary piece of journalism exploring the dramatic surge of rhino poaching in those areas, propelled by the exploding black market trade of rhino horns. We'll hear about this dark phenomenon, its impact on and implications for various rhino species and more when we speak with Peter Gwynn in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. Also a bit later in the show, we'll step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal comedy, of course. We'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a pair of tickets to Party Like a Pinup, an extravaganza of sorts. It's a benefit for pinups for pit bulls, featuring burlesque shows, live music, food, drinks, and more. An appearance by Shorty Rossi, too. It's all happening this Saturday, March 24th, at the Cuban Club in Ybor City. And on a related note, we'll chat briefly later in the show with Art Fibulant, spokesperson for the aforementioned Party Like a Pinup bash. So, want to remind you, as we did at the top of the show, that we're heading into fun drive territory. And so we'll be doing that April 11th through 18th. And love to get a running start at raising our money. So if you'd like to go to the, if you like Talking Animals, if you like what we do, if you like events like the Talking Animals Music Night, more about that in a moment, or past events like the Talking Animals Festival, or just the show week to week, We invite you to go to go to WNF.org, find the Talking Animals page on the website. And once you do that, on the upper right-hand corner, there's the tip jar. Slip a few bucks in, will you? 25, 50 if you can swing it, 100 if you can, more. It all goes to the station, of course, and just represents fewer dollars that we'll be needing to raise come fund drive. So appreciate that. Right now, though, it's time for the Animal News and Announcements segment. A look at items of interest in animal news, as well as announcements of local events on the horizon. Produced, as always, by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Reed News Department. Our first item, of course, deals with one of those self-same Talking Animals events. The Talking Animals Music Night, featuring 10 great bands from the Tampa Bay area and beyond, performing animal songs. It'll be held March 31st at New World Brewery, featuring a musically diverse slate of bands, including Sons of Hippies, Johnny Cakes and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypso, Rebecca Pulley and Rob Pastore, Ricky Wilcox and the Moonsnakes, Sunset Bridge Band, Talk to Mark featuring Scott Elliott, WMNF's own, host of the All Souls edition of It's the Music, returning today to his rightful spot right after Talking Animals from noon to three, Tribal Style, Acme Jazz Garage, The Happiness Machine, and Ray Zilla's PBS, featuring Ray Villadonga, one of the hosts of Step Outside, Wednesday nights from 10 p.m. to midnight right here on WMNF. So, if you're familiar with even just some of these bands, you'll know that the evening will cover tremendous ground musically. Americana, funk, folk, calypso, jazz, rock, reggae, world music, and more. Whatever the style or genre, all these bands will be playing animal songs. It's just going to be a lot of fun. We're now starting to really get a sense of what the bands are going to be playing, and it's all over the map in the most wonderful way. So don't miss this. Tickets will be a very modest $8 in advance, $10 at the door. Of course, a benefit, as always, for WMNF. And you go to WMNF.org for tickets or call 813-238-8001. During business hours and speak with Miss Julie. She will fix you up. So, and in the coming days, already happened a bit, but I know there's shows that plan to play at least some animal songs, sometimes devote their whole show to that. I know Joyce, this forthcoming edition of Shakedown Sundays from 2 to 4, will be doing that. Flea, I think, on Mondays, It's the Music. Marcy on the Tuesday morning show, and Randy on the Wednesday morning show, all going to be playing at least some, if not totally devote their shows to animal songs to gear up for the Talking Animals Music Night. So, should be a blast. And next Wednesday on this show, related to that, we'll have Gracie from Sunset Bridge Band, Ricky Wilcox from the, of course, Ricky Wilcox and the Moonsnakes, and Mark Murphy from Talk to Mark alongside Scott Elliott, doing double duty that day. So, it's going to be really, really, I think, a fun thing. We'll be hearing some acoustic animal songs, talking about animals and animal issues important to those folks and other things. So that's next Wednesday on Talking Animals, 1 week from today. And, of course, a lot of those bands that are playing Talking Animals Music Night are also playing Tropical Heat Wave. And I'd be remiss, I think, if didn't mention that we have an early bird deal on Heat Wave tickets. Usually, sort of, in the run-up to the fund drive, we ask $180 for a pledge for a pair of Tropical Heat Wave tickets. But we have an early bird special, especially if you call in today, 813-239-9663, or email dj@wmnf.org. We can give you a pair of Tropical Heat Wave tickets for a $150 pledge. Help the station, help yourself, get a early start on making your Tropical Heat Wave plan. So, on to some other news. Last week, after the show, I was filling in for Scott, who was really, you know, under the weather. Someone called and asked me, what do you think about the whole Trump pictures thing? And at that point, I hadn't seen it. But by now, I'm sure you've heard or read or seen the pictures that Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump have been presenting, if that's the right word. You can just find them pretty easily online. In the wake of their big hunting safari, showing posing with all kinds of animals that they killed on a big game hunt in Africa. One of which includes a picture of Donald Trump Jr. holding the tail of an elephant that he cut off that elephant. He may or may not have actually killed the elephant in the photo, but anyway, pretty disturbing. And of course, you know, I think right afterwards he said on Twitter, "I'm a hunter. For that, I make no apologies. I can assure you it was not wasteful. The villagers were so happy for the meat, which they don't often get to eat." And so on. Overlapped by a day or two, the news that the HBO series Luck was canceled. Still, I think, one more of the current first series episodes to air. But, you know, after the third horse that had to be euthanized during the course of production, and I think, frankly, a lot of other problems that surrounded that that show from HBO's standpoint, they pulled the plug. So, but some of the investigation and the kind of shape those horses were in to begin with before they ran and then had to be euthanized was, you know, well, anyway, not a minute too soon. So, also this just in, that's right. There's so many bands doing animal songs, I can't keep track of them. Surface Noise, of course, later tonight. Or actually, probably next week. Next week. What am I saying? I'm all confused. Anyways, next week, the 28th, we'll probably devote much, if not all of it's all animal songs, in fact, on Surface Noise. So that's next Wednesday, the 28th, from 6 to 8 p.m. with your host, Lounge Laura Taylor. So again, hard to keep track of everybody doing it. Sorry, and I probably omitted others, and I apologize in advance. Back to some animal news here. Tidbits, including an important thing, because this is really timely. The Traveling Exotic Animal Protection Act, H.R. 3359, is currently being considered by the Agricultural Committee of the House of Representatives. Your calls and emails are urgently needed to make sure this life-saving bill makes it out of committee. H.R. 3359 aims to amend the Animal Welfare Act by restricting the use of exotic and non-domesticated animals in traveling circuses and exhibitions. The AWA is the only federal law in the United States that regulates the treatment of animals used for exhibition and in research. The AWA also regulates the way animals are transported and how long circuses and exhibitors must allow the animals to rest between shipping. So please, please, please contact your representative in support of H.R. 3359, the Traveling Exotic Animal Protection Act. Coming up Sunday, our friends at Florida Voices for Animals are having their annual Have a Heart fundraising dinner and silent auction. That will be at Trang Viet Cuisine. And it's underway at 4:30 in the afternoon, goes to about 8 or so, and there'll be a guest speaker, as always, Michael Budke, who's the co-founder and executive director of Stop Animal Exploitation Now, and a really compelling speaker. I've heard him at other conferences over the years, and really a great speaker, and talking about really important issues, animal experimentation and lab research, etc. So anyway, that's this Sunday, the 25th, and for Florida Voices for Animals annual Have a Heart fundraising dinner and silent auction, and all kinds of information can be had by going to floridavoicesforanimals.org, or you can call 727-656-8368. And also Sunday, the Racing Dog Rescue Project's Adoption Center Spring Open House is this Sunday, March 25th from 1 to 3 p.m. The Adoption Center is located 1801 Verner Road in Miyaka City. Racing Dog Rescue Project is a 501c3 nonprofit whose mission is to rescue, rehabilitate, and find forever homes for retired racing greyhounds, and serving the counties of Manatee, Sarasota, Charlotte, and DeSoto. So you can find out more by going to the website, rdrp-greyhound.org, rdrp-greyhound.org. And on a related note, sort of, on looking ahead a little bit, April 4th edition of Talking Animals, I'm putting together, just about completed it, a roundtable on greyhound issues. April is Adopt a Greyhound Month nationally, and so we're going to have probably four panelists from across the country and with various points of view on greyhound matters. Adoption, tracks, some of the economy and how that's affecting tracks and closures and what that's doing to the adoption market and some of the other issues that are really, really important for Greyhounds and some of the relationships between tracks and Greyhound organizations and more. So that's going to be April 4th right here on Talking Animals. And back to locally, Hillsborough County Animal Services is presenting Help Our Pets, Adopt-a-thon and Egg Hunt, Saturday, April 7th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., Hillsborough County Animal Services at 440 Falkenberg Road, North Tampa. There'll be food vendors, scavenger hunt, contest prizes, dozens of rescue groups, hundreds of adoptable animals. Easter egg hunt starts at 11 a.m., photos with the Easter bunny, no less, and professional pet nail trims and more. So go to Hillsborough County Animal HillsboroughCounty.org/animalservices to find out more. And I think for now, at least, that's probably going to do us for our animal news and announcements. Let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. I was thinking about something hunting-related, not really aware of any bits about rhino poaching per se, but I thought this piece by Eddie Izzard might work close enough. Here's a portion of a piece called Fox Hunting, Fly Hunting. I'm Eddie Izzard on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
And fox hunting, I think, is still happening in this country after years because posh people want to get those foxes for what foxes did to chickens. And remember, posh people have had an alliance with chickens since the First World War. They go to the same clubs and go, yes, yes, I know that. Bark, 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 bark. Oh, really? Did you try that? Bark, 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 bark. With a workstation. Fantastic. Bark, 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 bark. Yes, excrement. Never really... So they chase in the red coats and the horse in the fox hunting thing, and they catch the fox. Mr. Fox, you must be culled. It is a scientific experiment we're doing. You must be killed. How would you wish to be killed? By lethal injection. It's the safest and most painless way. How would you like to be ripped apart by dogs? I'd really rather not, because it's just... Holy crap! Then they take the fox all bloody, and they take the young children, and they go, blah, 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 in their faces. And the children go, thank you, Father, for blood on my face, for I will never, never be, and one day I'll grow up to be captain of industry, or captain of a tugboat. So my idea is for posh people to do fly hunting, because no one likes flies. It's a win-win scenario. You get rid of flies, and the posh people can do their hunting, because they don't want to hunt a fox per se, whatever that means. They want to hunt anything that they can hunt, anything that runs away a little bit, like a turtle or a poor person or a member of the Labour Party. Anyone... So, give them fly hunting, give them a flamethrower each. Dun, 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 dun. Got two. There's one. Missed him. Sorry, Tasman. Bucket of water over there. Later that day. How did it go, Colonel? Got 45 flies. Fantastic. Two of our party died, I'm afraid. C'est la guerre. Would be so good.
All right, that's Eddie Izzard with a portion of a piece called Fox Hunting, Fly Hunting, taken from his album Live from Wembley. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. It's nearly time to speak with today's guest, Peter Gwynn. As I mentioned earlier, Peter is an award-winning staff writer at National Geographic Magazine, whose article in the March issue, Rhino Wars, examines the current state of rhinos and rhino poaching in South Africa and other regions. There's been a dramatic surge in rhino poaching in those areas, propelled by the exploding black market trade of rhino horns, highly valued in traditional Asian medicines, making it a sought-after commodity that can fetch the same price, in some cases, as gold. So in addition to writing the National Geographic piece, Peter is also the author of the upcoming ebook short, Rhino Wars, the Violent Underworld of Poachers and Black Market Medicine. So with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Peter Gwynn to Talking Animals. Good morning, Peter.
Hi, Duncan.
Thanks so much
for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals. And first, I just want to congratulate you on the piece at a time when Facebook posts and tweets are often the coin of the realm and blogs are maybe a bit too ubiquitous. It's just exhilarating to read a piece of long-form journalism that's deeply reported and just sort of poetically written that just tells a rich, compelling story, even if that story is often deeply upsetting as this one is. So, anyways, just congrats on that level. So let's before we get really into that article and some of the things it raises, let's first find out a bit about you. I mean, these days you're often reporting from sort of far-flung locations, yet I believe you hail from Georgia, right?
That's right. Yep.
And maybe you could sort of trace that path for us.
Well, boy, it's kind of a long path. I'm originally from Georgia, from, you know, little town, kind of southwest of Atlanta, and, but, you know, had a great high school English teacher that, you know, really inspired me to, you know, want to become a writer. And, I went to college and afterwards, ended up, teaching in Botswana, for, almost 2 years. And, while I was there, you know, was writing about Africa and, you know, sending dispatches back to my home newspaper, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, you know, with sort of grand ideas that I would become a foreign correspondent. And those were sort of, you know, I look back and those pieces are pretty horrible, actually. But and none of them actually made it into print. An editor explained to me that, you know, for people in the Atlanta area to be interested, there needs to be some hook other than just, you know, things happening in small villages in the southern, you know, part of Africa. So, but I got back and I moved to Washington, D.C. I became a freelance journalist. I worked for a lot of different publications and ended up working for a magazine that covered the European Union at a time it was, you know, really changing and covered the, you know, a lot of the countries that joined it and the rise of the euro, the single currency, and, you know, a lot of the Eastern European countries joining. And eventually that led me to National Geographic. And I've sort of, as you alluded, you know, I've done a variety of different kinds of things. Last year we covered the Tuareg of the Sahara Desert, and that's become a story of late because they were involved in helping to defend Gaddafi's regime in Libya, and we had spent, actually with the same photographer that worked with me on the Rhino story, we'd spent quite a bit of time with nomads, Tuareg nomads, and in the whole region, and some of whom were fighting a rebellion in northern Niger. So it just, you know, it turned out to be something that caught the news cycle just right. So anyway, and then rhinos came after that.
So was it in the course of just kind of the globe trotting and working on you know, other pieces that you became aware of the severity of the rhino poaching problem, what was the sequence? How did you?
So you know, obviously, you know, wildlife and the story of the rhinos is something that's very close to National Geographic. I mean, this is one of our core areas is conservation.
Sure.
And the photographer that I worked with on this piece, Brent Sturton, is from South Africa, and he had been tracking this story very closely, and he brought it to Geographic, and we had worked together closely, and the two of us, you know, are a good team, and that sort of it went from there. But the fact that Brent is from South Africa and knew a lot of the backstory, and that is something that, you know, we'll get into later. But you know, and it's a very nuanced, you know, story. I mean, the rhinos is getting the attention. It's, you know, the poaching is there, but it's a lot of the conditions that have been laid to create the situation, you know, not just in South Africa, but Africa in general and in Asia as well. And Brent was really familiar with, you know, what was, you know, pushing a lot of the conditions that were making it, you know, making poaching possible at this scale. So.
Wow. Okay. So it was kind of, I guess helpful to have him, you know, because it is complex. I mean, and you do, you know, as I mentioned earlier, a great job of telling that story, but it's a complex story with a lot of, issues, international issues, some very colorful characters that hopefully also we'll get into, and, But so that's probably great that you had Brent there to help kind of navigate through some of the very tricky terrain, I mean literally and figuratively on this. So let me just let folks know, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're talking with National Geographic staff writer Peter Gwynn, whose article in the March issue, Rhino Wars, examines the dramatic surge in rhino poaching. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask Peter a question, offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. Because one of the things, Peter, is that if someone wasn't paying close attention, you know, prior to your piece hitting, they could kind of be excused for thinking that rhino poaching had sort of largely subsided and was not really, or was no longer, I guess I should say, an issue.
And, well, you know, that's true. And, you know, in fact, you know, one of the great success stories up until recently was the white rhino, the southern white rhino. There's five species of rhino. There's two in Africa, the black rhino and the white rhino, and then some, you know, subspecies within those species. But that's the main ones.
Mm-hmm.
And the white rhino had been poached almost to extinction by the turn of the 20th century. I mean, there was something like 20 left of the southern white rhino, and South Africa really was at the forefront of creating preserves and breeding, and they brought it back. And now today there's, you know, on the order of something like 25,000, I think, of those white rhinos, with the majority of those being in South Africa, and it's thanks to those efforts. And if you look at over time, poaching, you know, there's always poaching in the sense that, you know, people take poaching of opportunity is sort of what it's called, you know, bush poaching.
Sure.
And that's not as great a concern to conservationists because it's a relatively small localized scale.
Mm-hmm.
And if you looked at over the past years, you know, statistics for poaching in South Africa were really manageable numbers. I mean, 2000, there were seven reported poachings. And these are, you know, when they find a carcass, you can assume that there's probably more, but still, seven reported carcasses is tiny. By 2007, it was only 13. You know, it kind of rises and falls. But then the very next year, 2008, we saw a stark jump, and that's where people started paying attention. There was 83.
Yeah.
The next year, it's 122. 2010, it shoots up to 333. And then last year, we hit a new record of 448. So you can imagine, I mean, that's a stark, amazing jump in poaching, and that marks a whole different kind of thing. That's not poaching of opportunity. That's, you know, syndicates, and it points to a much larger issue.
Yeah, well, let's delve into that, because I mean this does seem like, as you've kind of explained, sort of, you know, a singular story in terms of poaching and what it means and who's involved, and also it seems like it's partly rooted, or at least potentially rooted, in the absurd. I mean, maybe you could tell us about the rumor surrounding some major figure in Vietnam whose cancer was ostensibly cured by rhino horn, and then somehow this crazy surge in the killings that you just detailed was attributed at least partly to this guy.
Well, you know, to back up just a little bit,
sure.
You know, rhino horn has long been a part of Asian traditional medicine. It's there's apothecary treatises from 2,000 years ago in China that talk about using rhino horn, you know, to treat various kinds of maladies. And some of them are, you know, from things like bad dreams and, you know, bad breath to fevers and typhoid and things like that. So it's long been part of the tradition. And actually it was even used as, created a big stir on Antique Roadshow when some rhino cups, you know, they make these ornate cups out of rhino horn. And these things actually, you know, some people say had legitimate, purposes in the sense that the rhino horn is made out of this keratin. The rhino horn is a protein. It's like horse's hooves. It's the same general idea as the stuff that our skin and hair, you know, is made of, that keratin protein.
Yeah.
But when these cups were used, powerful people thought, you know, if they were worried about being poisoning, which was not an uncommon thing back in the medieval period, the cups, because of this, they were made out of this keratin, would bubble, would cause, you know, if it came into contact with a poison that often was alkaline, the cup, because it was the way, you know, the protein in it would, mm-hmm. would signal somebody. So there, you know, so it had some legitimate sort of uses back in, you know, in this, you know, this ancient period.
Sure.
And going forward, that's been carried on through the tradition. So moving up to the current thing about the rumor about the cancer thing, you know, like I said, Asian medicine is continues to be practiced. It's, you know, very, you know, a lot of people believe in it. Even people who have, you know, I met doctors. We traveled to Vietnam and met many Western-trained doctors that practiced a hybrid of both Western and, you know, Asian traditional medicine.
Yeah.
And one of the theories is that, you know, it doesn't necessarily cure cancer, one doctor told me, but that it can be treated, used as part of a suite of treatments. You know,
mm-hmm.
somebody that might get chemotherapy might also be taking some traditional treatments to help with the side effects of chemotherapy. And, you know, rhino horn, you know, ostensibly is one of these things. I talked to, you know, a variety of different cancer patients that took it, and they took, you know, a variety, you know, like one, I talked to one woman who was the widow of a mathematician. This guy was, you know, super highly educated, and, you know, he personally didn't, you know, believe that the rhino horn thing, but his family members convinced him that why not, you know?
Right.
And that's kind of what I think a lot of people feel like, you know, when you're facing something life-threatening or your family member's facing something life-threatening, you know, you'll try anything, you know, to try to save them.
Right. Well, and that's kind of goes for the at one point in the story you described traveling around with the around Vietnam with a woman who had gotten kind of a disturbing looking mammogram and had that exact attitude, like, hey, I'm gonna go check this out. Why not do it? You know,
yeah.
I mean, and but you really sort of get into some things where you sample the kind of the way they shave the horn you and that woman each took a swig and
Well, the other thing that we need to add here, you know, Duncan, is that, you know, the science actually on whether rhino horn works or doesn't work is very thin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is something that, you know, it's, you know, I in no way bring this up to encourage anybody to use rhino horn,
sure.
you know, as medicine in
yeah.
no way, shape, or form. But by the same token, I think it's important to point out that, you know, before we go and completely dismiss any sort of, you know, medical side effects, we have to say that, you know, it hasn't been fully studied. There have been a couple of studies that tested whether or not it actually had fever-reducing properties, which is one of the current, you know, the common beliefs in traditional Asian medicine, and they were inconclusive. The World Wildlife Fund did a study was involved in a study. One of the founders of the World Wildlife Fund is an heir to the La Roche chemical company, and La Roche conducted a study back in the early 80s, which was not peer-reviewed, and they said that it showed that it had no fever-reducing properties. I asked the World Wildlife Fund and La Roche for a copy of the study, and neither of them can come up with it today. Now, I don't think that's I don't say that because I just didn't get the chance to read it, and as
yeah.
any other scientists get a chance to review it.
Yeah.
So, and World Wildlife Fund has, you know, recently or, you know, in recent years has said they don't know for sure whether it has any effects or not.
Yeah.
But be that as it may, that doesn't change the conservation landscape that we're looking at.
Sure.
Rhinos are being, you know, killed and that's got to stop.
Right. Well, let's see. There's folks who, of course, want to get involved in the conversation. Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Truss. My guest is Peter Gwynn, National Geographic staff writer, whose latest piece, Rhino Wars, appears in the March issue of the magazine. And we invite you to join the conversation, 813-239-9663, or emailing dj@wmnf.org. Let's get one of these callers in. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Peter Gwynn.
Hi, it's Clay from Land O'Lakes.
Hi, do you have a question for Peter?
I appreciate all your hard work. Yes, I do.
Great.
But I'm going to preface it with using another animal, the orangutan, who right now is limited to, I think, its population is the islands of Borneo and Sumatra. And that is because the number one thing that's happening, and it's happening with a rhino too, isn't it the loss of habitat as much as it is poaching?
Well, okay, thanks for your call, and go ahead, Peter, if you'd like to respond to that.
You know, I don't think that the rhino, I mean, loss of habitat is definitely affecting, you know, animals all over the planet, and it definitely has an impact on rhinos, certainly in, you know, the Asian rhinos, the Javan rhino, and the Indian rhino, you know, that's a critical issue. The thing about the white rhino and the black rhino, and specifically in the southern part of Africa, South Africa, you know, those populations have been managed for a long time. I mean, you know, the country of South Africa, you know, the wildlife is, you know, Kruger National Park is, you know, was created sort of as a wildlife preserve, but the whole country, the wildlife is carefully, you know, managed. Or the landscape is managed in such a way. And, you know, and like I said, you know, the white rhino population had grown back from, you know, 20 to nearly, you know, 20,000 in South Africa. So, you know, I don't think that that is the, is critical, you know, to the potential, to the question that we're talking about right now with the poaching. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, while, habitat loss is, that's affecting wild animals, you know, all around the world, and it's certainly an important conversation. But I think with the with regard to the poaching spike and epidemic that we're looking at right now, that isn't you know, that's not the front and center issue.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, habitat is always an important thing to address any of these kind of issues. But I think as you kind of recap there. I mean, the fact that upwards or more, maybe more now, I guess, but I can't do the math. There's, you know, 1,000 rhinos basically in the last 5-6 years that have been poached, where the numbers were, you know, barely registered prior to that. I mean, does bespeak, again, as your piece really makes clear, a very different and sort of dark phenomenon, and some, as I alluded to before, some very colorful characters, for better and worse, that sort of are laced throughout this tale. Maybe, I mean, we don't really have time to address them all, but maybe we can hit a couple. I mean, Gideon Van Deventer, maybe you could, for our listeners, sketch, who haven't had a chance to read the piece, a quick portrait of him drawn from your, you know, prison interview and some of the sort of odd and dark things, you know, sort of swirling around his criminal enterprise he was involved with, and again, just how high the stakes are now in the rhino horn black market.
Gideon Van Deventer was a, you know, really interesting guy. He was a poacher that got in on the, you know, when the spike just started coming in to play. He was recruited by a, you know, a professional hunter. I mean, the professional hunting industry is very big in South Africa legally. So there's, you know, still a lot of safari hunting that goes on. But there is a dark side to it as well. And, he was recruited, by, a syndicate involving some professional hunters to, you know, to go out and take down rhinos. And this is a guy that was, he grew up, you know, kind of in the bush. He's from the northern part of South Africa, and he basically told me that he had, you know, been hunting, you know, since he was a kid, you know, tracking animals, and just sort of, you know, felt it more at home in the bush than he did in the, you know, in any other kind of life, and just loved it. I mean, had a genuine appreciation for the environment and nature, and, you know, but he was a hard scrabble guy, and, you know, there's a lot of money on the line, and I think some of it was the challenge too. So I met him in prison, and where he's serving, he was finishing out a term for poaching, and he had agreed to cooperate with the police at that time to help them bring this syndicate, you know, to testify against other members of this alleged syndicate. And you know, he basically just sketched out, you know, how he learned to hunt rhinos. He'd never actually hunted a rhino before this. He'd hunted, you know, hunted lion and elephant and cave buffalo, but he never actually shot a rhino, and he went about it very methodically. He got a copy of a book called Perfect Shot, which is sort of the Bible of hunters and South Africa, and it basically, you know, outlines the anatomy of every kind of animal that you might want to hunt and tells you where the kill shot is and what kind of, you know, caliber weapon to use, what kind of, you know, bullet to use, et cetera. And, you know, went about this very methodically. And, you know, the other issue is, you know, to do this stealthily, you know, he was looking at different ways to try to do it with a minimum of sound. So I think he first told me that he started trying to do it with a crossbow. But the cross, you know, trying to get a kill shot on a rhino with its heavy hide, with a weighted arrow and all sorts of, you know, other sort of, you know, additional sort of measures taken, you know, wasn't very effective because it didn't bring the animal down quickly enough. Mm-hmm. So then they switched to a high power rifle with a homemade silencer, and you know, and little by little he learned. And one of the things he talked about, which was, you know, how a lot of guys, you know, bring a chainsaw or have to sit there with an axe and try to, you know, chop off the horn. But he figured out that, you know, there's a little trick to it that actually, if you take a knife and just kind of draw, you know, scar around the edge of the horn, it'll pop right off.
Yeah.
And so little details like that just, you know, made his story very, you know, added some, you know, some veracity to, you know, what it's like on the other side of the poaching equation.
Yeah. Although, yeah, at times as he was describing that and some definitely kind of perfecting the silencer, whatever, I just found it chilling, you know, but just, sort of, you know, as you described kind of his technique for removing the horn, just only have probably another minute or two left, Peter, but I think this might bring us right into, at least in our time remaining, briefly touching on John Hume and his operation. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
John is a really interesting guy, and one of the important things, you know, I think for listeners to understand, which I learned and found surprising, was that, you know, a lot of people compare rhino horn with elephant tusk and ivory in the ivory trade, which is, you know, it's fraught with its own, you know, issues and long, you know, dark history, and rhino and elephant poaching continues to be a major problem. But the difference between the two is that the rhino horn isn't a tooth. The ivory is an elephant's tooth, and the rhino horn, actually, if you cut it off, but not, you know, with just a couple inches above the snout, it grows back. It's like a horse's hoof in that sense. You know, the animal doesn't feel any pain. In fact, a number of places had gone to cutting the horns off to dissuade poachers from hitting their animals, but it's expensive to do that. It can be you know, a difficult process, you know, to undergo this every 2 years for, you know, somebody who's like a you know, raising rhinos as a, you know, for game animals, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So John Hume is a guy, he's a wealthy guy, and he started buying up rhinos and taking off their horns. Now, it's illegal for him to sell the horns, but he's stockpiling them, thinking that eventually the trade will be legalized. And, you know, he makes a strong argument that, look, we can harvest rhino horn sustainably, and, you know, and there can be a legitimate market, you know, for certified rhino horn, and maybe that's not the long-term answer, you know, going forward 100 years, but maybe it would offer a bridge to, you know, to another solution whereby, you know, education catches up in Asia and, you know, some of the practices would be, you know, would fall out of favor. So, it's an interesting thing. I mean, as he points out, hunters, there's been a rash of Asian hunters that come over and try to legally hunt rhinos. They are allowed to export the horns back as trophies. That's still legal in South Africa. They pay a lot of money for it, but they're glad to do it. And he points out that these same, you know, Asian hunters would be just as happy to come and dart the rhino and, with a tranquilizer, to, you know, cut the horns off and let the rhino wake back up and start growing another pair of horns that they can come back and harvest, you know, 2 years later. And it's a, you know, it's an industry that would provide jobs and, you know, it has no detrimental effects to the rhino. People ask, would this leave rhinos, you know, unprotected? Well, you know, rhinos have very few predators. You know, only the young are sort of subject to things like lions or hyenas. You know, even a rhino without horns, you know, is a big, heavy, animal that, you know, can do a lot of damage, you know, even if it's not spearing you. And in fact, some, some zoologists point out that, you know, many rhinos actually end up, are, you know, killed because they're jousting with each other, and that when you take off the horns, you sort of eliminate some of those deaths. So there's sort of a, you know, there's a lot of interesting sort of comments to be made about that.
Sure.
The downside of this, and this is the argument that conservationists rightfully bring up, is that South Africa has a pretty advanced, you know, game industry and more law enforcement in place to sort of manage this sort of thing. Places with less infrastructure, like Kenya and, you know, to some degree, Tanzania and other places that have rhinos, could be more vulnerable. They, you know, it might be more difficult to, you know, by creating a legalized trade, you might bring some of these other populations of rhinos under threat from poachers because they wouldn't be as carefully managed. And that's a legitimate concern to raise. But, you know, Hume points out that as we're going now, we're on pace for, in South Africa, for more than 600 rhinos to be killed this year. They've killed 135 as of today. So,
again, I think as we've given listeners probably a little bit of a sample, it's a rich and complicated story. Again, we've been speaking with Peter Gwynn, staff writer, National Geographic. His story, Rhino Wars, appears in the March issue of National Geographic. And also, I should quickly add that there's also an e-book. Is that available yet, The Rhino Wars, The Violent Underworld?
Pre-orders are available at Amazon, iTunes, and BarnesandNoble.com.
Okay, so if you hear about this and want to find out more, or read the article first and then find out more, Peter has written an e-book delving even further into it. So, Peter, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals. And again, thank you for just an extraordinary article and again, all that went into producing that article.
My pleasure, Duncan. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you. Okay, so this is Talking Animals. You're listening to, and the show website is TalkingAnimals.net. It's time to see the Name That Animal tune. There'll be a prize, a pair of tickets to Party Like a Pinup, the benefit for pinups for pit bulls this Saturday, March 24th at the Cuban Club, featuring burlesque shows, live music, food, drink, and more, and Shorty Rossi. To the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune, which, by the way, will be played by one of the bands performing at the Talking Animals Music Night. So in a moment, we'll chat with the Art Fibulant about Party Like a Pinup. Right now, it's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. If we get some guesses, we'll try to take those off the air. But right now, I want to welcome Art Fibulant from Party Like a Pinup. Good morning, Art.
Good morning, Duncan, and thank you for nailing my name right.
Appreciate it. It took a number of email exchanges, to be honest, to our listeners, but I was determined to get it right. So anyway, so tell us what exactly, I've kind of alluded to some elements of, but what exactly is Party Like a Pinup? What's its purpose?
Our purpose is to introduce people who may not have met pit bulls before to get an understanding of how great these dogs are, and they are completely different than what the media portrays them as. So what we did was we took that and we wrapped it in a really fun, sexy, fantasy type of event to encourage people from all walks of life in the community to participate in the event and get a chance to meet a pit bull up close and personal.
So, in other words, beyond all the cool things that I've mentioned a couple times in the course of the show, the burlesque shows, the live music, the food, the drink, Shorty Rossi, there's actually going to be pit bulls there that people can meet and hang out with?
Yeah, we are going to have a couple of dogs there. There's two dogs coming from Dolly's Foundation. Dolly, who was the namesake of the organization, was adopted through an Orlando animal control and ended up with a dog fighter, and she came back completely messed up. She got adopted, and she is just a classic example of a beautiful, wonderful, big-hearted pit bull girl. Then there's another dog who will be there. His name is Harper. He was featured on the Today Show about 6 months ago. He had something called Swimmer's Syndrome, where he was splayed out completely flat. And through just love and attention from all the rescue people, he's made a 100% recovery, and he's going to be there as well.
Wow. So there's some true celebrities of the canine world that will be there.
That's right. I think Shorty might get upstaged by the dog.
Yeah, well, and again, I mentioned a couple of times, but Shorty Rossi will be there, kind of, I guess, sort of the host or ceremonial host. You know, people know him from Pit Boss on the Animal Planet, of course.
Exactly.
And, so this sounds great. So without mentioning prices, which we can't really do, I mean, what will partygoers expect? I mean, it sounds like they'll have dog encounters. They'll have a chance to rub elbows probably with Shorty Rossi. And what else is going to go on at this extravaganza?
Well, it is an all-night event from 8 o'clock to midnight, and there are burlesque shows that will be taking place through the evening. There's a great silent auction that we're doing. Companies from all over the country have donated things to this event. The ladies from Pinups for Pit Bulls in New Jersey are flying down to participate in the event. There's going to be a great open bar and food around for everybody, and it should be just a fantastic night of fantasy and fun and fundraising for dogs.
Well,
just a blast.
Wow, it sounds great, great, great. And again, it's the proceeds do go to Pinup for Pit Bulls. Everything pretty much goes to them. That's right.
We will have local rescues there as well. They will have booths at the event as well. So people who want to make donations to the local pit bull rescues can do that as well.
Cool. So you got the choices.
We want to make sure that we support everybody here as much as the national organization.
Well, that sounds really great. And I believe this is the second year of the event, Art. Am I right?
It is.
Thinking? Yeah. Okay, cool.
The first one was so big, we ended up having to move it to a bigger venue. So we're having it at the Cuban Club this year on the top floor. You guys are very famous with the whole Cuban Club thing.
Sure. Yeah, Heat Wave, et cetera, and other events. Yeah,
yep,
yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, that's a good problem to have when you have to move to a much larger space. So obviously it's people are having a great time and serving all kinds of purposes and raising money. And so this is really cool. So, again, it's Party Like a Pinup. It's this Saturday, March 24th. Gets underway at 8 p.m., sounds like, from what Art's saying, an all-night affair. So that's who knows what that means, but I guess you'll have to come and find out. And so, again, you can find out more details beyond what we've discussed here at partylikeapinup.org. And, Art, thanks for joining us on Talk Animals and filling us in on this cool event.
Well, thank you very much, Duncan, for having us. And we're looking forward to having everybody in the community there supporting this great organization and supporting the dogs that we love.
Cool. All right. Well, good luck. We hope it works out beautifully. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
All right. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Of course, Sunday brings the long-awaited return of Mad Men. So, background music, a little salute to that. Anyways, then we'll be back next Wednesday, March 28th, with a very special edition, as they say. In cliche land of the program, featuring a few performers from the forthcoming Talking Animals Music Night. Gracie Grishup of Sunset Bridge Band, Ricky Wilcox of Ricky Wilcox and the Moonsnakes, Mark Murphy of Talk to Mark, alongside guest vocalist and WMNF programmer Scott Elliott, who will be coming up momentarily here for the Also's edition of It's the Music. So we'll be playing some acoustic animal songs, chatting about animals and animal issues that are important to them, and more, all in preparation for the Talking Animals Music Night, Saturday, March 31st at New World Brewery. Find out more about that at WMNF.org. Get your tickets now. Don't miss it. Anyway, so it's all going to be fun and cool. Hope you'll join us then. Also, hope you visit our website, TalkingAnimals.net. We'll make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page or Twitter feed and more. That's all found at TalkingAnimals.net. And speaking of websites, again, hope you'll consider going to WMNF.org, finding Talking Animals in the schedule, find our page, and support us by slipping a few bucks into our tip jar. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby Busalis. My thanks to her. My thanks, too, to my silent co-producer and co-host, Mike Strauss. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for the fabulous aforementioned Scott Elliott, who's back, healthy enough to be here with us. We're happy about that, doing the All Souls edition of It's the Music, airing next from noon to 3. Yay! Closing out today's show, as always, with an animal tune. This one happens to be one that we know now will be performed by one of the 10 bands playing at the Talking Animals Music Night. This is Mike Snow with Animal, taking us right up to the NPR News on WMNF Tampa. We'll catch you next Wednesday at 11 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks so much for listening. It's WMNF Tampa. Take care.